While I'm getting hooked up here, let me tell you a story. In December of 2010, a man walked into a Quick Trip service station convenience store in the north part of Des Moines, Iowa, and purchased what would turn out to be a $16.5 million winning lottery ticket in the Hot Lotto game that was being run there and administered by the Multi-State Lottery Association, which runs lottery games all over the country. That ticket was never claimed. After a year or so of it sitting there, the money was eventually distributed back to the participating states and everybody got on with their life for the most part. But some investigators were digging into this, figuring out what was going on. And eventually, they convinced the governing authorities to release videotape from the Quick Trip to show the person who had purchased the ticket. And the man was eventually identified as a man named Edward Tipton, who just so happened to have been the security director for the Multi-State Lottery Association. Ah, now it all starts to come together a little bit. Well, charges were filed exactly 1 year ago last Friday, January 15th of 2015. Charges were fired against Mr. Tipton for fraud. He wound up being convicted on two counts and is currently serving a 10-year sentence. But it does not end there. A couple of months after his sentencing, more charges were filed against Mr. Tipton. Apparently, he is also being implicated in more lottery rigging scams. And there are even more scams that have been discovered that they seriously think that he may be attached to. So there may be even more charges down the line. Now, I am not a professional researcher by any stretch. This information, I did not find this. It found me. Yeah, it's readily available. And you would think that, especially given the time frame, that it was just a year ago that this prosecution began, you would think that everybody would be talking about rigged lotto games and how it's a $292 million chance when it's an honest game. And it turns out it's not an honest game, at least not always. But as it turns out, you probably were blanketed with lottery news, Powerball news last week, but not, I venture to wager, if you'll pardon the expression, not using the name of Edward Tipton. And the reason is, I think, that people are a whole lot more interested in $1.6 billion that they potentially could win if they happen to put the right formula together, and how they might go about spending that. Now, how many conversations did you have in the office or whatever that about what would you do with $1.5 billion? You didn't find out, apparently. There wasn't a winning ticket sold in Florida, in Melbourne, Florida, I think it was. That one hadn't been claimed. A couple of them hadn't been claimed. One, I just found out, I was digging a little bit and found out that the guy in Tennessee that won, he has turned his in. And he's going to take the immediate payout. It's not enough to get like $1 million a day for the rest of your life. He's going to get the whole lump sum right at once. $400 million just right at once. That's the way he wants to go. Because you don't live forever, he says. Well, that's just nice. Anyway, if you're thinking that I'm going to be up here telling you that Bill Jones is going to go to hell because he bought a $2 Powerball ticket, that's not the intent of the sermon here today. I can't find a thou shalt not lottery ticket. A lottery game passage in the Bible. That's not the point. The point is this, that when our society gets consumed as it is with not just money, but the acquisition of money, the acquisition of large amounts of money with little to no effort involved, that is going to bring out the absolute worst in a culture. That's going to bring out the absolute worst in a human being. It's not nearly so much a matter of can I buy a Powerball ticket and still go to heaven. That's not the issue that I want to discuss today. What I want to discuss is the love of money and the compulsion that we find in our culture that drives people toward this quick fix. I realize everybody's got money problems. I get that. But the idea that I can somehow just scratch off a certain series of numbers, or I can plug in a certain series of numbers or whatever, and just all of a sudden, boom, I'm a multi-zillionaire, and I'm never going to have to work for the rest of my life. I'm not going to have to you know, ask parents for help anymore. I'm going to have to do, you know, there's a lot that's wrong with that. There's a lot that's wrong with that. And that's what I want to focus on here today, instead of the lottery itself, rather the attitude that goes into the lottery. I would suggest to you that the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, as Paul tells Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 6. We read that just a few moments ago. We're going to talk a little bit about the various roots that it is. A root of discontent in the first place. I doubt very seriously that before people started playing lottery, that we put our heads on the pillow thinking, man, wouldn't it be nice if I just woke up one day and had $100 million? Wouldn't that be great? We didn't do that. We didn't think about doing that. When there is no option other than living in the present, living in the now, we're content to live in the now, by and large. Now, we might like to have a little bit more, or a little bit softer, or a little bit cleaner, or nicer, or whatever. But as far as aspiring to this gobs and gobs of wealth, this is a relatively new thing. You might have aspired in your 20s to be able to retire as a millionaire in your 60s. Now, that's one thing. After 40 or 50 years of hard work, fine. But to just happen upon this money, like the fellow that Jesus tells the story about in Matthew chapter 13, that's new. And that's a bad, bad thing. Life is not intended to be spent in a pursuit of the next thrill. To just go through life hoping that the big one is going to be coming, as it were. To get excited about being excited. We're told over and over again that, especially in the book of Ecclesiastes, which I'm going to refer to here in a second, life is not about what you might have at some point in the future. Life is found in what you have already, not in what you do not have. This is the contentment that the honest, regular guy, as it were, that Solomon is talking about. Now, you might argue that Solomon didn't know a whole lot about being honest, regular, poor guys. But nevertheless, he does speak words of wisdom here by the inspiration of the Lord. He writes in verse 18 of Ecclesiastes 5, "Here's what I have seen to be good and fitting to eat, to drink, to be enjoy oneself in all one's labor in which he toils under the sun during the few years of his life which God has given him, for this is his reward. Furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he has also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is a gift of God, for he will not always consider the years of his life, not often consider the years of his life, because God keeps him occupied with the gladness of his heart." What he's saying here essentially is God wants you to be happy. God wants you to be contented and satisfied with the things that you have. And that's the key, to find an attitude where you can enjoy what you do have and get so caught up in what you have that you don't spend a whole lot of time worrying about what you don't have. And I greatly fear that our culture is consumed with the pursuit of what you don't have. It's not about having enough or having what I want or what I need. It's having more and more and more. It has nothing to do with how much I need. How many people out here need $1 billion? Yeah, you might say you want $1 billion. You could use $1 billion properly and you'd be a good steward of that money, and maybe you would be. But we don't need that in any sense of the word. I don't know that anybody who would say that they do. Jesus is going to empower us to find contentment in where we are. And this constant chase for the big kill, for the big check, is exactly the opposite of what Paul writes about, for instance, in Philippians chapter 4 and verse 12 and 13. And you know the text there. How the Lord empowers him, he says. I found the secret. I've discovered the secret to being in want and abounding. And he says in verse number 13, I can do all things through him who strengthens me. Having Jesus as the focus of our life, having Jesus as the center of our existence here on earth, has a very strong tendency to mitigate all of these cravings that we have for things that are at best moral neutrals, and that very well may be counterproductive to our efforts to serve him in this life. They may very much get in the way instead of assisting us in any kind of way. When we find ourselves in a state of love of money, What we are saying essentially is, I cannot be happy. I cannot be content where I am. And think about that for a second. God put you where you are. If God wanted you to have $1 million, if God wanted you to have $500 million or whatever, God can arrange that. That can be done. And I'm not saying God's out to get you or anything like that. But the fact is, God has put you where you are. And he expects you to serve him and to honor him where you are. And if you're saying, I cannot find contentment where I am, you're not finding contentment where God has placed you. And so therefore, it's a gesture of disrespect, of a lack of faith in God's stewardship of your life. What God wants us to do is, and this is not saying here, you can't go to the boss on Monday morning and ask him for a raise or anything. I'm not saying that. That's your business. But if you ask for the raise and he says no, that's not the end of the world. That's not even the end of your budget and your financial situation or whatever. You continue to trust in God. You continue to live in faith and allow God to show you a way to exist where you are in a way where you can honor him and glorify him and take care of your basic physical needs and maybe have a little bit to share with others while you're there. Secondly, I suggest to you that the love of money is a root of laziness. Now, I'm going to introduce you to a young lady here. This apparently is a real woman. At least her GoFundMe page is real. There's a woman named Cinnamon Nicole who has a GoFundMe page that at last report had about $800 in it. So people are contributing to this thing. Cinnamon Nicole on her GoFundMe page writes this. Please help me and my family as we have exhausted all our funds. The typos are not mine, by the way. We spent all of our money on lottery tickets, expecting to win the $1.5 billion, and are now in dire need of cash. With your small donation of at least a dollar, a like, and one share, I'm certain, I get this is a good part, that we will be able to pick ourselves up from the trenches of this loss and spend another fortune trying to hit it big again. Please, won't you help a family in need donate now? Well, isn't that just great? Losing one lifetime of savings, however much that may have been, searching for the big kill, that didn't work out so well. So what we're going to do is we're going to beg for money from total strangers and put together another $500, $600, $700 bonanza or whatever and spend all that on lottery tickets. Now, does it strike you that this is not exactly in harmony with the concept of work as work is generally defined in our culture? I'm aware that there's blue-collar jobs and white-collar jobs that some people work in a comfortable setting, and some people go out there and dig ditches. I get all that. But this is not work by anybody's definition here. In fact, this system that we've built for ourselves, where it is possible for somebody to gamble away everything that they have and then go beg for more money where they can go out and gamble again, this is counterproductive to the lifestyle that God wants us to have. We were made to work. This goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 2, where God put Adam and Eve to work before the fall even. I don't know exactly what that work constituted, tending the garden, the text says. I don't know if that means, you know, pruning shears or picking fruit or whatever, but they were given a job to do. God has always intended his people in this life to be busy about something productive. We were not made to have other people work for us. It's not the job of my fellow citizens to make me rich. Or even to make me comfortable as far as that goes. I'm told anyway that this recent Powerball, the chances of winning the ultimate prize, the big one, was 1 in 292 million. Now, I don't know if the partial payouts like we're apparently going to get from this, if that's three winners out of 292 million. But I do know this, that as the numbers started climbing and climbing and climbing, lottery tickets went crazy. Now, I don't know how much time you spent around people who like to play Powerball on Wednesday afternoon, but apparently over a couple hours' time, Wednesday afternoon, they sold like 13 million lottery tickets. All over the country. People going bananas for this as the day grew closer and closer. Well, that's not work. Nor is it work, by the way, to take time off from your actual job to fantasize about playing lottery. planning to subsist on others' donations is not what we are supposed to be doing. In fact, it's the opposite of work. Paul writes in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 28, that we are the one who steals is to steal no longer, he says. Now, and the person who steals, we understand who that is. That's the one who takes something from somebody else without their consent. Okay, well, is it morally better to take it from them with their consent? Well, you can have that discussion if you want to, but the same basic point is going to apply. The one who steals is to steal no longer. Instead, he's supposed to labor with his hands, but he might have something for himself, and that he might be able to help someone else in time of need. A big part of our work ethic is so that we can provide for people who are genuinely in need, not people who have made themselves destitute, not people who have dug a hole for themselves, who refuse to work for themselves, but rather to help those who are in genuine need. And this culture that we developed with regard to laziness is exactly the opposite, I fear. And in fact, not only a word or two about 2 Thessalonians and 1 Timothy chapter 5 also. There, it's not just a matter of who deserves money and who doesn't deserve money and that sort of thing. There are people who are genuinely impoverished. There are people who are in genuine need. We had discussions in our elders and deacons meeting just this evening about the need of certain brethren in Zimbabwe, and I don't doubt for a second that their need is real, far more obvious than any need that you or I have likely ever come across in our lives. People who are trying their best and laboring with their hands and just not getting very far. It's entirely appropriate for Christians to get involved in the lives of people like that and help out in whatever way we can. On the other hand, we read in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 8, if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he is denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. It is not the job of other people to take care of my family. It is my job to take care of my family. And that has implications regarding church policy. The text says in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, with regard to the lazy one, who, verse number 6, the one who leads an unruly life not according to the tradition which you receive from us. For you yourselves know how you ought to follow our example, because we did not act in an undisciplined manner among you, nor did we eat anyone's bread without paying for it. And on he goes here, talking about his example of work. When he was laboring for the Lord, in his spare time, as it were, he did what he had to do to put food on his own plate, and then with the extra time that he had, he went out and preached the gospel. That was the example of work that Paul and his companions left for the brethren there in Thessalonica. He says in verse number 10, but even when we were with you, we used to give you this order, if anyone is not willing to work, then he is not to eat either, for we hear some among you are leading an undisciplined life, doing no work at all, but acting like busybodies. And he says, now such persons we command and exhort in the Lord Jesus Christ to work in quiet fashion and eat their own bread. So you take care of yourself. That is your responsibility as much as is possible. And when we develop this mentality in our society where it is the government's job, or it is society's job, or it's the 1%'s job, or whatever candy coating you want to put on it, doesn't matter what color it is. Not my job, basically what we're saying. When it becomes not my job to take care of my personal needs, my personal monetary needs, I've denied what the faith is all about, Paul tells Timothy. And that's a relatively strong language, I would suggest to you. I would also tell you, suggest to you that the love of money is a root of competition. And I say that a little bit carefully, because those of you who have watched me in a sports kind of environment, or those who have played board games with me or whatever, I've been called competitive in times past. I didn't necessarily chafe at that characterization. I think that's probably fair. There's nothing wrong necessarily with being competitive. But there is something wrong, something very wrong, when I see my existence as being pitted against my fellow human beings. It is me versus them. It is I'm going to get mine or he's going to get his. Succeeding at someone else's expense, as it were. When I seek to benefit because someone else lost something, I see that as exactly the opposite of what Jesus tells us in Matthew chapter 7, verse 12. The so-called golden rule, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. We usually paraphrase that. Now, how exactly does that work in a lottery setting? And somebody says, well, I'm only taking $2. You know, what difference does that make? Well, okay, if that's not that big of a deal, what, instead of buying a lottery ticket, why don't you take your $2 and give it to your buddy who wants to buy lottery tickets? Save him the trouble. Here, you've already won. Here's your $2. And watch him go spend it on lottery tickets. But anyway, if you think that it's not that big a deal, then go ahead and lose. Because let's be honest, you're going to lose anyway. Right? So why not just go ahead and skip the whole lottery process and give away? No, I want to do that. Well, why not? Well, because they want to win. And when they want to win, of course, what they mean is they want everybody else to lose. Do you think there's any frustration in the minds of this winner fellow in Tennessee that he's getting this $392 million payout or whatever? You know, if those other two guys hadn't bought that ticket, I'd get the whole almost $1 billion payout, $980 million check written to me. Wouldn't that be cool? Now I'm gonna have to settle for only $400 million. Oh man, what a shame. Well, that's not necessarily the most healthy attitude that we could have, I suggest you. And when we get into extremes of competition, and by the way, if you're competing for $1.5 billion, I would suggest to you that's extreme. And I would, and you can do some research on this. You can find out that extremes have been taken to find this money. We talked about Edward Tipton before. There are people who fake lottery tickets and do all kinds of duplicitous kind of things. Change the dates on their ticket or change the numbers or whatever it happens to be. Doing all kinds of, you know, beyond dishonest activity, this criminal activity that people are doing to try to defraud their fellow human beings so that they are the ones who get the big payout and not necessarily anybody else. Now, we are, as Christians, supposed to be blameless and innocent, children of God, above reproach. And there are many other characterizations that we have in the text that fly absolutely in the face of this notion that I can just take, and, you know, hey, if you ain't cheating, you ain't trying. If you're, you know, no holds barred, I'll do whatever I got to do to get what's mine. That is the opposite approach of what we ought to have. And I suggest to you that any number of lottery tickets, down to one, is going to a certain extent at least participate in this process. Now, you can be your own moral judge as far as this goes, how much you love your neighbor when you're buying your lottery ticket. That's between you and the Lord. But think for a moment how much we are tacitly participating in this moral outrage that's going on in our society. I think I have one more point before we close up. A root of carnality. Maybe this is the most obvious thing. If you found out that you were going to win $1.5 billion, it would be very difficult, I suggest to you, to not focus on carnal things. Now, to a certain extent, you can't avoid that. To a certain extent, it's good, in fact, to focus on your physical responsibilities. We read about that from 1 Timothy chapter 5. The one who doesn't do that is worse than an infidel. Yes, you have obligations. Yes, you need to meet those obligations. But the more time and the more energy and the more affection that we spend in carnal areas, the less we have left over to spend in spiritual areas. When Jesus tells us, seek first the kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you, in Matthew 6 and verse 33, what he's saying there is that the carnal responsibilities ultimately are turned over to God. You just serve me. You focus on that. But when instead we become obsessed with carnal things, physical things, we lose sight of what's truly important. It's been a while since I actually read from Colossians chapter 3. This is one of my favorite passages, as many of you know. I'll go ahead and read this again. In verse number 1 of Colossians 3, therefore, if you have been raised up with Christ, keep seeking the things above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on the things above, not the things that are on the earth. Going through verse 4, he says, for you have died and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, is revealed, then you will also be revealed with him in glory. Marvelous glory is waiting for those who are spiritually minded, those who have spiritual focus. And if you are so caught up in the glory that comes with winning $1 billion, I suggest to you it's going to be much more difficult for you to focus on spiritual things. And by the way, this carnality will destroy you. it's worth noting here. We're not going to tell a bunch of horror stories about lottery winners and what happens to them, what happens to their money, and all that. I was just reading the other day about this fellow who won this gigantic payout, and 2 years later was living in a container unit full of grime and he was addicted to drugs and all kinds of horrible, just awful stuff. And that's not the only example. We go on and on with these. You do your own research on that. This increased focus on physical things is going to take us away, ultimately, from what we say is the only important thing in our life, let alone the most important thing. The only important thing is Jesus. That's where our mind is set. Well, let's live that way then. If that's really our priority, then let's get rid of the things that are going to compete with that. Now, you can't get rid of everything. You're going to have to live in the world. But surely there is a way for us to avoid the extremes that our world is going to present to us, trying to dredge us deep, deep into this carnal, fleshly, sordid sort of lifestyle. The text says in Matthew chapter 6 and verse 19 through 21 that we are not supposed to lay up our treasures here on the earth. And that doesn't mean, I don't think Jesus means you can't have a bank account, you can't have a sock full of quarters in your closet or your underwear drawer or money stuff in your mattress. I don't think that's what he's saying there. It's a comparison. It's that not but phrase that I keep talking about. He says, but lay up for yourself treasures in heaven. Because the things of this earth get corrupted, they get destroyed, they get lost, they get stolen. The treasures that we lay up in heaven, he says, are eternal. They are secured for us. And he says, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. And that's an interesting turn of phrase there. I've read that my whole life, thinking where your heart is, there your treasure will be also. If you really cared about Jesus, you'd invest in Jesus. Which I guess is a valid point, but I'm not sure that's what he's saying there. He says, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. It seems like what he's saying is that your affection is going to follow your interest. That if you will heavily invest in Jesus, if you'll put your treasure in Him, if that's where you put your focus, you're going to love Jesus all the more. Your heart is going to be there. It's tough to be dedicated to Jesus at this level without caring about Jesus. And it works the same way with money, by the way. If someone is spending hours in front of the computer trying to work out logarithmic patterns and such, trying to find meaning in the numbers, and this number has been pulled so many times, and this number, and the statistics say that these should be the winning numbers, and you spend hours and hours and hours working through all of this, and exactly how many tickets you ought to buy them, and where you ought to buy them, and all. If that's where your focus is, if that's where you're investing your treasures of money and time and energy and affection, it's going to be tough for you to argue that's not where your heart is. Yeah, that's where all the rest of you is. So surely that's where your heart is as well. Jesus wants us to show that same kind of affection, that same kind of focus, the same kind of drive with regard to spiritual things instead of carnal things. Put your heart in Jesus is what he's saying. Nobody ever accused people of having too much love of Christ. Not in the church, anyway. That person, he's just too spiritually minded. That's his problem. He's too focused on heaven. He spends all his time talking about heaven. No, that's not the problem, is it? That's not a problem at all. What does become a problem if we're not careful is getting so caught up, and you don't have to be Powerball hungry, by the way, to have the love of money. You don't have to have money to have the love of money, as far as that goes. If we get so caught up in this world, and the things of this world, and there's nothing that's more of this world than money, by the way. That's carnal as it gets. You can use it for good things, you can use it for bad things, but there's no argument that it's carnal. And if that's where our focus is, if that's where our affection is, then it's telling us that that is not where Jesus is in our heart. And so I would encourage you here this evening to invest in Jesus. To let him give you the big payout, as it were. Because he's got a jackpot that is far bigger than anything that the Multi-State Lottery Association is ever going to shell out in another million years of lottery games, if we happen to live that long. And it's on the horizon. I don't know exactly how long it's going to be before the Lord comes, but in the scope of eternity, it's not very long for sure. Maybe in the very immediate future. Why don't you make your life right with God? Why don't you invest in Jesus and make Him truly, in every sense, the Lord of your life? If we can help you with that regard, if we can help you into the water of baptism, if we can hear some kind of confession of wrongdoing to help put you back on the straight and narrow, whatever we can do to help you, please come in as we stand and sing at this time to encourage you.